Greetings to the brightest audience in the country, and welcome to Theology Thursday. I'm Nicole McBurney. Every weekday, we bring you the news of the day, the culture, and science from a Christian worldview, but today, join me and Pastor Bob Enyar as we explore the source of our Christian worldview, the Bible.
This is the man who wrote, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." So he does know that. That's there in his mind. But when God said, "Do not multiply wives," and over a period of many years, he kept adding every week to his harem, he had turned his back on God. And when God said, "Don't worship other gods, especially don't worship Molech," and he builds an altar to him, so he knows the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Yet he stopped fearing the Lord. Verse 14, "There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens, according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity." Now, the word vanity or futile does not accurately describe this condition because of the coming judgment day. He's saying, look, some people are good and bad things happen to them. And there are other people that are bad and good things happen to them. Therefore, everything is futile. That's not true. That is the worldview of someone who doesn't believe in a righteous king. Because when evil people get wealth, that wealth is stored up for their judgment. And it's not going to go well with them at the end. If you are very short-sighted and you're only looking at the time that the Bible describes as a wisp of air or a flowering grass that fades away, in that short period of time, it looks like the wicked are better off. But in reality, they're not at all. At this point in Solomon's life, he is experiencing extreme pessimism. And he's brought gloom to a literary art form. Verse 15. "So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun." So, five times Solomon says this in this book of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing better that a man can do than eat, drink, and be merry. Now, is there any possible sense in which that's true? Any possible sense? No. There's no possible sense in which the best thing a man can do is eat, drink, and be merry. There's nothing better that you can do. You can't humble yourself before God. You can't serve your neighbor. You can't feed the hungry, because you have to be home partying. Of course, you could go out and feed the hungry, but there's nothing better to do than to eat, drink, and be merry. Now, if Solomon said that once in a proper context, okay, eat, drink, and be merry, I'm all for it. I'm in. You know, where's the party? Where's the picnic? I'll go. But as we see, as we continue, that's not it. This is Solomon's summer of discontent. Only it turns into fall and winter. He became critical of God and of life, and therefore exaggerates man's dilemma, and he gives bad counsel on how to live one's life. Now, nothing better than to eat, drink, and be merry. In the episode of the golden calf in Exodus, Moses wrote that the people were eating and drinking and playing. And then God destroyed. Remember, 3,000 with the Levites. In Matthew 24, Jesus described the days before the flood when they were eating and drinking until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away. Jesus also spoke of the evil servant who eats and drinks with the drunkards. And that's not a phrase of a spiritual life or commitment or maturity or growth. It's not wrong to eat and drink and make merry unless you do so as an attempt to find meaning in life, to find the ultimate fulfillment, to find what's most important in life, is just to have good friends and party. That's not true. If for you, eating, drinking, and being merry are out of priority, then you have a problem to solve. So five times in Ecclesiastes, in chapter 2, we saw this, Solomon said, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. In chapter 3, he said, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. In chapter 5, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. Here, he says in chapter 8, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and be merry. In chapter 9, he says, eat and drink wine with a merry heart. Now, I don't want to beat a dead horse. Those things are okay unless it's your obsession and your goal to find fulfillment in life. Solomon is guilty of urging these otherwise healthy activities to an obsessive degree. Verse 16, when I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, in other words, if you fully dedicate yourself to wisdom and understanding, to know how the world works, then, verse 17, I saw all the work of God that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. I applied everything I have to wisdom, and I saw that a man cannot find out what is done under the sun. In other words, it's hopeless to find out why things are the way they are. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. Solomon is very skeptical here and negative, and I think it's uncalled for. Remember the wisdom God gave him? Two women claim the same baby, and he figures out who's the real mom and who's the kidnapper. And he didn't have any witnesses. He just had tremendous wisdom to see into an unknowable situation, because wisdom helps you to perceive the truth behind the facade. But here Solomon says, no matter how much wisdom you possess, no matter how much God blesses you with knowledge and understanding, you will never know anything that will help you. It sounds like bah humbug to me. Chapter 9, for I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. Now, what do you think of that? People do not know love nor hatred by anything they see. Is that all people? Or is that both the wise and the fools? Neither God's people nor his enemies can identify love nor hatred. We can't see love in the action of Boaz, nor hatred in that of Pharaoh. Of course we can. Can we see love in the Good Samaritan and hatred in Herod? We can. What is Solomon's implication when he says that we are in the hand of God? What a nice thing to say. We're in the hand of God. That's nice, right? He implies by his previous statement and the subsequent one that therefore we're in darkness. We can't see anything, right? Let's use the next verse. Okay, let's just look at that again. The previous verse, no matter how hard we try, we can't find out anything. And the next thing he says in chapter 9, verse 1, we can't know love nor hatred by anything we see before them, because we're in the hand of God, and he keeps us in darkness. It's all a mystery. We can't know. You see how it depends on how you go to the book. If you go to the book and think Solomon is repentant and righteous and writing as a godly scribe, then you focus on we're in the hand of God. In the confusion that comes before it and afterward, you gloss over. If you think, on the other hand, that Solomon is fully backslidden, then you take the little gems of wisdom as leftovers, and you see the confusion as his main theme. And during the break, Jason asked, well, why is this book in the Bible? Why would it be in the canon? And Carl answered that this was inspired stupidity, that if someone wanted to know what was wrong, you look in the book of Ecclesiastes and you'll find what is wrong. Now, I'd like to use the next verse to compare the two styles of interpretation of Ecclesiastes. The one I've been using, we could call the backslidden Solomon's confusion method, and the more common one, that Solomon was spiritually alive and repentant. This here commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, it's very popular, published by Zondervan, very good. And they say that Solomon was evil, but he repented, and he wrote Ecclesiastes after he repented. That's what they say. And I ask, well, where did they get that he repented? Where is that in the story? Because it's not in the account of Solomon's life. So they said that Psalm 89 proves that Solomon repented. So I thought that was fascinating because I didn't think, I thought, okay, let's see. So Psalm 89, it says no such thing, but it does say that God established a covenant with David. And then it says that if David's sons forsake God's law, God will punish them. It says that. And then it says that nevertheless, God will be faithful to David. It says that. It doesn't say that Solomon repented. It said if David's sons are evil, God will punish them. That's all it says about his sons. That's it. And then when it says, but God will remain faithful to David, they say, oh, see, Solomon must have repented because God would be faithful to David. Huh? Where did they get that from? Obviously, they haven't read the chapter on that God will not punish a child for his father's sins or bless a child for his father's righteousness. So verse 2, let's look at it and see how you could take it. You know, you could try to take it either way. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Now, is this brilliant, inspired truth, or is it corruption from a debased mind? Which is it? Are all things come alike to all? Well, not salvation, not forgiveness, not righteousness, not mercy. And, you know, some things happen to everybody. It rains on the just and the unjust, and we all die, except for Enoch and Elijah and in the last generation. But as is the good, so is the sinner. And he who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Now, since Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say Solomon repented, and this is all inspired truth, they have to make sense out of every verse. And every time when Solomon says, the best thing is to eat, drink, and be merry, they have to find a way of affirming that, which effectively is to deny it. They say, of course, the best things are to love God and love your neighbor and do all this. And if you do all the best things, then it's okay to eat, drink, and be merry. But that's not what Solomon said. He's saying everything else is useless, so the best thing you could do is eat, drink, and party. But what they say here is they say this. To deal with this one verse, and we could go through the whole book like this, but they say all things refers to death. Let's say all things comes to all, and this whole section of the next 8 verses refers to death, pretty much, especially this verse. Well, not really. All things, that's plural. come to alike to all. And as is the good, so is the sinner. And he who takes an oath is he who fears an oath. That doesn't have anything to do with death. He's saying no matter how you live your life, you're all going to end up in the grave. So I say, no, Solomon's not referring just to death, but he's referring to life in general, and whether a man is good or evil, the good man is as the sinner, and he who takes an oath is as he who does not. Verse 3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. And that's a rather discouraging perspective on life. Right? This is an evil that one thing happens to all. Well, could you say, you know, everything's evil in life because everybody dies? Well, it's appointed unto men once to die. That was God's idea. If we sin, we would die. It's not evil that we die. It's a part of reality. It's evil that we sin. But the sons of men are full of evil and madness is in their hearts while they live and then they die. Not all hearts are full of evil and not all hearts are full of madness. Moses, Barnabas, Joshua, John, Nicodemus. It would not be correct to say that their hearts were full of madness while they lived and after their period of insanity, then they died. That wouldn't be right to say of the great men of God. That's not how God sums up the lives of Noah or Enoch or Abraham or Moses. God doesn't sum them up like that and say their lives were nothing but futile madness and then they died. Verse 4, but for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Okay, that's an interesting point, and I guess that's true. But even in this, Solomon is sarcastic. He's being sarcastic when he says a living dog is better than a dead lion. Because look at verse 5. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. So the living, the dead, at least the dead don't know anything. But the living know they're going to die. So the dead dog is better than, a living dog is better than a dead lion. But when it comes to human beings, we know we're going to die. And the dead don't know anything. And the dead have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. But God doesn't forget the righteous who've passed on, and neither do we for that matter. The righteous have a great reward. Yet Solomon laments the righteous and the wicked together. Rather than distinguishing them, instead of contrasting them, he goes out of his way repeatedly to say the good and the bad are in the same condition and they're all going to die. And then they have no reward. Verse 6, also their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So when you die, your love perishes. Now that's annihilationism, but even of the righteous, that's everybody. That's the Sadducees. You see, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees did not. So the Pharisees had very few verses they could quote, but they grasped onto a few. The Sadducees would turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, and they'd say there is no resurrection because in the dead you don't know anything. You're like an animal, and there's no love nor hatred. And nevermore, after you die, you will never have a share in anything done under the sun. It's not true. Love never fails. It never perishes. It survives death. Love is even greater than faith and hope, and neither of those will perish either after death. And as regards having a share in the things done on earth after death, those Jews who believed in the resurrection of the righteous, they knew that believers would be raised to live forever in Israel's earthly kingdom. So they knew there was something they would do after death if they believed in the resurrection. Remember, Abraham sacrificed Isaac, or he almost did, and we're told in the New Testament that he believed God would raise him from the dead. In this next verse, Solomon tells a lie, the most damning type of lie, the kind of statement which provides a false sense of security to those headed to hell. Verse 7, "Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works." Oh, really? Is that wise? To tell people, don't worry about God, he's happy with you, just make sure you party hardy. That should be the verse we put on every college campus. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. And be dressed to celebrate, by the way. Verse 8, "Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil." A little bit ago, he was saying, it's better to mourn than to have joy. You know, was he saying that because it was really true or wise or an enduring perspective? No, a chapter later, he's saying, it's better to party, anoint your head with oil, dress in white, and be merry. Because God has accepted you, so don't worry about that. So is he talking about those who are self-righteous? Or is he talking about those who are already accepted? He's not talking about anything. Verse 9, "Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain and pitiful life." Well, he didn't say "and pitiful," but it just flowed off the tongue. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. That's hysterical. God cherishes every human life so much so that Christ died for us. And we were worth enough for Christ to sacrifice, to come down from his position in heaven, to die for us. A human life is of inestimable value. It's not futile. It's not worthless. It's not vain. "But live joyfully with the wife whom you love," I'm all for that, "all the days of your life, which God has given you under the sun." Notice your vain life, which God has given you, your meaningless existence, which God has given you, because you're in his hand. And that's why you can't understand anything. "All your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun." Look, he's saying, you're a futile being. Your life is meaningless. There's no difference now or after death between the righteous and the wicked. So just enjoy your pitiful existence while you can. Enjoy your wife, although I don't know how you will enjoy one when I haven't been able to enjoy a thousand of them. Verse 10, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." That was Solomon's strategy with marriage. "For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going." Right? Whatever you find to do, do it with all your might, because when you die, that's it. You lost your chance. So what if a schoolyard drug dealer reads this? Or a pimp? Or a Republican? Well, I shouldn't have put them in there. But there's no work in the grave? How about for the righteous when we judge the world and the angels? How about for those who repented in Nineveh when they judge Christ's generation? There will be plenty of work for believers in the hereafter. Verse 11, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happened to them all." Now, there's a lot of truth in those observations, but there's also a lot of falsehood. And if you mean them in the right perspective, yes. But if you mean them in the midst of utter pessimism, gloom, and doom, then no. He says the race is not to the swift, but Paul said the opposite to the Corinthians. Nor the battle to the strong, but Paul said, put on the armor of God and be strong in the Lord. Nor bread to the wise, but David said, I've not seen the family of the righteous begging bread. Nor riches to men of understanding, except for the riches of God's inheritance for us. Nor favor to men of skill, except Joseph the carpenter, God favored him. But time and chance happened to them all. Now that is something I can agree with, wholeheartedly. But not in Solomon's way. He implies that the wise are no better off than the wicked, and only chance occurrences differentiate their lives. Not true. And as for his other observations here, yes, often the wicked prosper, but only temporarily. We should never lose sight of the eternal. Verse 12, for man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. And he's referring to death, and that we can't know when we die. It happens suddenly, but life is only livable that way. Verse 13, this wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now, I don't know what city he refers to. That information may be lost to us for now. But he explains in verse 15, now there was found in it, in that little city, a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. That's pretty cool. A poor wise man in a city besieged by a great king, and his wisdom helped to protect the city. He delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. Well, Solomon remembered him. He just wrote about him. And if he would do less grumbling and more constructive authoring, we'd know a lot more about the guy. Verse 16, then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Amen to that. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Now, he did just say they heeded his words, and he delivered the city. So, and he's a wise man, and I think he's lamenting that his wisdom didn't work because he describes his own empire as filled with oppression and injustice, and the officials and the judges are all corrupt. That's how he describes his own country. He's the king. If they're all corrupt, it's his fault. So he's complaining, nobody listens to wisdom. And poor little me and all my wisdom, and no one listens. I think that's what he's saying. Verse 17. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. And of course, in the case he laments, that happened. The words of the wise were heard. Verse 18. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Agreed. Agreed, and Solomon there writes something that we can fully accept without qualification. Go wisdom. And yes, a sinner can undo, in a moment, he can undo a lifetime of good. May God bless you all.